Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast. I'm Sian Kane. It's never been easier to become an author, but in many ways it's also never been harder. While self-publishing, blogging, and crowdfunding have opened up new opportunities for writers, there are also the challenges of dwindling author earnings, the declining sales of literary novels, and just the everyday pressures of life to navigate while writing. So it's a good thing to have things like the Desmond Elliott Prize, which is intended to help debut UK novelists write a second book. Today I'm joined by two of the three shortlisted authors up for the Desmond Elliott Prize this year. We've got Paula Kokotza of My Own Blood, The Guardian's very own, whose debut novel, How to Be a Human, explores loneliness and wildness and humanity's relationship with nature. And we've also got Priti Dineja, who regular listeners will remember came on the show last year with Carmilla Shamsi, and she's talking about the same book, which is her debut, We That Are Young, a retelling of King Lear in modern India. Gail Honeyman, who's the author of Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine, is currently overseas and can't be with us today, but we have Preeti and Paula. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Well, first up, congratulations. And I know some people are very cynical about prizes and the significance of them, particularly when it comes to books and literature, and how many book prizes there are and whether that cheapens it in any way. But a huge part of the economics of books and art, and I think generally a lot of financial benefit comes with prizes and the sort of critical judgment process that comes with them. So whether or not people like that is kind of another point, but the Desmond Elliott Prize, which was set up in memory of the late literary agent to reward specifically debut novelists by giving them a bit of money to help with their next book, I think is really, really important thing, particularly as authors are sort of struggling a lot of the time to find their feet, particularly financially, to make that step into writing full time. So I think it'd be good to start with both of you talking about what was the decision like when you decided I'm going to write a novel and I'm going to try and make it as an author. Was it a very weighty decision for you, or was it almost incidental and you realised you'd actually done it? Paula, how about you?
So it was quite recent for me, just a few years ago, and it wasn't a weighty decision, but it felt like a decision I almost didn't have a say in. It felt quite inarguable in a funny way, because I was working at the time. As you said, I work here at The Guardian, and I had two young children and no time really. And I just decided I had to write. I mean, I just started almost without a sort of a mental decision. And then I applied to do an MA because I realised it was going to be very hard to continue to write without making it a timetable part of my life. Mm. I didn't feel it was something I could just squidge into the gaps of time around all the other things that needed time. I felt I had to be able to say, OK, on Friday, that's what I'm doing, or on Tuesdays, or whenever it was. But it had to become formal somehow.
And so was it a process that you fit writing in around your life, or did you have to really make time specifically to have that time alone to get in the headspace and write?
Yeah, I feel that life actually had to fit around the writing, in that although the writing was taking up the smallest slice of physical time, kind of perhaps I had 7 hours a week when I had both childcare and no job to be at, in terms of kind of emotional and imaginative engagement, I was always elsewhere. Well, God, that sounds terrible, doesn't it? What a bad mother I was then. But yeah, so it took up more of my emotional and imaginative and mental time and energy than my other pursuits did, or that was proportionate to the physical time it took, let's say.
And how long did it actually take from sort of starting to write How to Be Human and it hitting bookshelves? I
wrote the first draft in a year and the second draft in a year. And then I sold it at that point. Mm. And then it was just over a year before it came out.
So it's about 3 years old.
Roughly, yeah.
And Preeti, how about you? How did writing fit into your life?
Well, I had always wanted to be a novelist and write fiction. It's my first love. I didn't give myself the right to do that until I was 35. I had been a young carer till I was 28. And after that, the person I was caring for, which was my mother, she died. And I had to make a decision then, you know, I had to get my life back together and start getting paid work and making good on the promise of a university degree and so on. And that took me into writing in a roundabout way, first of all working with a human rights organisation, working with young people across the UK, and then reporting for an advocacy organisation on minority rights. And I kind of got to the phase where I had been talking about, I really wish I was a writer for so long. And my friends and my partner were like, you know, you just have to do this at some point. And I started looking into courses for quite similar reasons, that I had to have this time that was allowed. But it was very much about allowing myself to say, I'm on a course and therefore I have to do this. I took the MA in creative writing part-time around my job. And then when I felt like I had, you know, proved to myself that it was worth sticking on, I applied for the PhD and I was lucky enough to get funding. So I quit my job.
And you use the word, like, giving yourself permission. I mean, I think I get the sense a lot of the time with people that are not necessarily just in writing, but in creative fields and producing art, that they sometimes feel a bit of guilt or a bit of selfishness because they do need to take that time by themselves to dedicate themselves to something that isn't another person, that is entirely involving just you and your creative forces and your imagination. Was it ever that you felt selfish or, you know, guilty for needing to dedicate the time?
Personally, I think it was because I just felt that it wasn't so much selfishness. It was more like, unless there was a formal framework and a justification for me taking the time to do this piece of work, I should be doing something else. I should be doing something that earned money, was more productive, had goals that you could say, I've done this and look at my job, it's contributing in some way to my family life. I suppose that is a kind of selfishness, but it was more like thinking, yes, I can do this as well.
And how long did it take for you to write We That Are Young? Because it's a chunky book.
Yeah, it's a long novel. I'm very averse to fat-shaming novels. So let's just call it, I don't know, involved. I wrote the first draft on the PhD in creative writing over 3 years, which also included doing a piece of critical research work as well. So you write two parts of the PhD. And it went out on submission in 2013 to absolute deafening silence. So over your question was, you know, from writing to shelf, it's taken 7 years.
God, that's amazing. I mean, that's part of publishing, I think, that a lot of people these days tend to sometimes get around that by self-publishing. Did either of you consider self-publishing at any stage?
I didn't. And I think that's partly perhaps linked to that question of yours just now about permission. Because although I didn't feel I needed to justify kind of the selfish act of writing to all the different bits of my life, I did feel I needed to accommodate everything and keep my job and keep my children. So I think I didn't want to self-publish because part of what was important to me was to be able to publish in a way that was a sort of a formal recognition of something. Because I'd never really, although I'd written in my head somehow all my life, I managed to get to the age of 40 without actually writing a single word of fiction. I didn't feel I had any entitlement in that area. I didn't have a kind of a childhood of, you know, a house full of books and parents who were super into books or anything. They had kind of other things they were into. So I always felt like a bit of a visitor in that world. And so part of feeling that I could do this was about doing it in the formal way, so that one felt one did in some way fit.
And how about you, Preeti?
I never thought about self-publishing because by the time that question would have been in my mind, it had just gone through so many no's. I just thought, well, clearly something isn't right here. So why would I then put it out there myself?
Had it sort of knocked your confidence a bit, that whole process?
Yeah, it was really hard. Yeah, of course it does. It knocks your confidence. You do internalise some of the messages. And I think what I've learned about the publishing world since then is that sometimes those no's are much more complicated than you're just not the writer.
Yeah.
You know, they're very complicated, and the writer on the receiving end of a rejection never really knows that until after you come out of the other side of it. But, you know, I really admire people who self-publish in a way, because you have to do everything from design to proofing, and to really get it right and then find a market takes an enormous amount of time and energy, which I just simply didn't have at that stage.
And when you got to that publishing process, when you were finally accepted, was it surprising? Were there any bits of the process that you went, I was not expecting this, this is something I would have to think about or deal with?
Well, I'm published by a very small independent called Gallybegger Press, and Ellie Miller, who's the she's the editor there, she and I work very hard on my text, and I suppose it was a real privilege to have that attention to detail, and it certainly wouldn't be the book it is without that, even though, you know, they bought it pretty much as it is. There was a lot of work that then went into making it good. I mean, good in the kind of finished builder sense rather than good writing.
How about you, Paula? Was there anything unexpected, any lessons that you learned while you were going through that process?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very long time. I know it sounds quite quick, but the gap between selling a book and seeing it published was, for me, it was over a year in which I repeatedly went through the text from one end to the other, read it so many times. You'd think it was impossible to read a book that many times in such a short space of time, and read it in lots of different ways. Read it, so my book features a fox. I've read it, edited it, for instance, just for the fox from start to finish, edited it for each of the main characters from start to finish, then did a line edit with a ruler so I could just look at the words above the ruler, and that took about 3 months just for one edit. So it was laborious, and it felt like it went on and on and on. But at least I felt afterwards, yeah, I had done what I could. Yeah. You have to stop sometime.
And we mentioned before we're talking about with your lives outside of writing the book, there's also the financial side of it. Now, we are actually expecting, there's a survey that's done every sort of 5 years or so called the ALCS survey, and we're actually due the next one in a couple of weeks' time. And the survey kind of tells us what the state of the financial side for UK authors is, which can be really, really informative. And the last survey that was done, which was in 2013, I think shocked a lot of people, whether they were in or outside the publishing industry, because it showed that the sort of median earning for a professional author in the UK was £11,000. And just to give like people a sense of how little that is, it's usually advised, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation says £16,000 is about what you need to have a minimum standard of life a year in the UK. And only 11% of professional authors, we were talking about this before, Paula, only 11% of professional authors actually earn the majority of their earnings from their writing, which is a huge amount of, it's 89% of authors that actually don't earn the majority of what they earn from their books. Coming in as you have, sort of fairly recently, you know, you're only one book into your careers, were you aware of that, that was the sort of state of affairs for authors? Or was it really just, I want this book to be out in the world, and it wasn't necessarily that maybe you would have a living from writing books?
I definitely felt no expectation of earning a living from books. I mean, in a way, just the writing, the creating something, that felt, it feels like, you know, itself kind of sustaining in a way. If you've got another life outside it, an income stream, then you can treat it as something that doesn't need to deliver financially. You can write free of any sense of how much money you might make from it. Having said that, if you do want to see it published and in the world, somebody needs to see it as commercially viable. You know, it needs at least to have the prospect of making what it costs to make and repaying someone's investment. I think I'm not surprised so many people have other jobs, and 89%, yeah, it's a big number, but then I think that's probably right. Authors do need to be in the world as well. And I think a lot is made these days of people who write and work outside writing. I think for me anyway, I've been glad of it. If I just wrote and didn't work, I probably would barely leave the house. I'd become a full-time recluse. I wouldn't need to talk to anyone. So I think it's good. It keeps you in the world, and books have to come out of the world and go back into the world. And it feels kind of feels right to me. But yeah, it's sort of sad as well.
How about you, Breezy?
Well, I think there's so much in what you say, Paula, and it's true about being in the world. It's really important. I mean, we both did degrees to get our writing careers off the ground, and we were taught by people who were also professional writers. So there you have an example of someone who may be a very big name. They may have won awards and so on, but they're still teaching. And they're not doing that just for the love of teaching. I mean, they all do love their teaching and they're brilliant teachers. But there's also a financial imperative there that even if they are super successful, they're also doing something that makes a regular income and puts something back in the world, and they are growing as much as I teach now, so I understand that, it you know, you get as much out of it as you put in as well. And I don't think it's that healthy actually to do just the other businesses that come around being published, like going to festivals or writing comment pieces in newspapers or whatever. I think it's really important to stay in the worlds which have made you the writer that you are, and perhaps further that practice as well.
Yeah, I mean,
whatever it is, whether you're a teacher or you're a volunteer or a, I don't know, nurse or something. I mean,
all these experiences might feed into your writing.
They might do, yeah.
Make space this weekend. Space for films about Chilean romance, plays about millennial angst, and poetry that makes you want to write poetry. Those new jackfruit superfood samosas, or not. A writer that's never been written about. The manager you might love, and opinions you might not. It's your weekend. Make space to be inspired. Pick up The Guardian and The Observer this weekend.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's sort of about once a year now at this rate that Will Self comes out and says the novel is doomed as a cultural form. And he seems to view a lot of this through the financial side of things, that, you know, even big well-known names, when you look at their sales, they're often not huge. And compared to the 80s and 90s, when it was kind of a guarantee that you could then maybe toss in your job and become an author full time.
Maybe never have had a job in the first place.
Yes, that's true. Exactly.
Amazing.
You know, inherited a bunch of money and went and wrote on an estate.
Yeah.
I mean, he seems to think that that is sort of the sign that the novel is somehow doomed. But actually what you're saying, it kind of sounds like perhaps that if novelists are forced to be out in the world, whether it is through financial necessity or whatever reason, it could possibly lead to slightly more interesting books, given that life experiences will feed into them.
If you had all the money in the world, would you still want to be in the world? I don't know if it's about being forced, it's about being interested, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. With all the money in the world, you'd have to volunteer or I don't know, you'd have to put yourself in out there in different ways, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, look at Arundhati Roy. She's a real example of someone who was stellar famous. She gets published first novel and it goes 40 languages worldwide. It's sort of a kind of literary phenomena. And she takes that money, she gives some of it away, but she spends the next 20 years doing activism.
Yeah.
Which is really important. And yeah, she writes books off the back of it and more money gets made and so on and so on. But there are choices that you can make about how you want to live in the world. And I think we'll sell, should maybe read our books and perhaps then decide whether the novel's dead. Because I think I can clearly see and tell you that it's not. Perhaps the novel is he likes it or understands it, but certainly not.
I think it might be that, yes. Yeah. So I was a bookseller in a past life, but certainly in my job here at The Guardian, I see all the books that come into the building to be reviewed, and the vast majority of them are coming from publishers, but we also get self-published books sent in as well. And I hear from people that have worked on the desk much longer than me that we are at a sort of unprecedented volume of books at the moment, that we are receiving more and more and more. And that might be in part to do with self-publishing, but also the fact that the publishing industry is sort of working quite hard to produce as many books as they possibly can for whatever sort of business reasons that they have. Do you ever feel the weight of that? I mean, because you are obviously both readers and you'll go into bookshops yourself and you will see your books on the shelves, but you also see alongside it how many books are coming out at the same time and how many books you are sort of competing with for people's attention, as well as the things that aren't books that are taking people's attention. Are you sort of aware of trying to win an audience, or are you sort of very content in the fact that your book is something that is out there and it might find a reader?
That's a tricky one. Definitely, I feel a thrill when I walk in a bookshop and see my book. Yeah. I don't think, God, there are a lot of books in here. I think, oh, there it is. It always gives that little bit of joy. And it's right that there are loads of books. I think it's great. And people will gravitate towards the ones they want. I myself stand there reading the blurb and then the first paragraph before I decide what to spend my money on. And I like the fact that it's part of that dynamic and part of that choice. And in a way, I think, well, for me at least, the readership, you know, it remains a sort of an abstract idea in my head. I try not to worry about how many people might be reading or buying it. I feel like that's probably someone else's worry, and perhaps when I've written the next one and I hear what, I don't know, and it goes out to wherever it's got to go, perhaps I'll need to start thinking about it more then, I don't know. But at the moment, I just feel the relationship is with the work, and the work then has the relationship with the readership, and I feel there's that kind of buffer there, and it doesn't detract from the joy of seeing it alongside other things. In fact, it's actually quite a nice game to go and see what it's next to. And if it's really? Next to Lincoln in the Bardo or something, it's like, yes, next to George Saunders.
Yeah, I don't think there's an author alive who probably hasn't snuck into a bookshop and turned their book face out. put it on the table next
do a little
to someone
adjustment.
They admire.
Yeah.
We all do it. I love that feeling of going into bookshops and seeing the book. And because there was so much time spent going into bookshops and going, wow, everyone else is writing,
yeah.
You know, and wanting to feel part of that community. It's really brilliant. And also spotting your friends and going, oh, I know her. So that's nice. And no, I think you're right. I don't think too much about who the reader is or how many books I'm selling and things like that, because the publisher trusts them to keep an eye on those things. And readers, so far this year, it's just been so surprising to me who has connected with the book, which if I had stopped to think about it, I probably would have said, oh, this person or this kind of reader. But, you know, it's a story.
Mm.
Everybody loves a good story. How it's told is almost as important, or if not more important, than what it's about, in a way. And that's been wonderful to get that kind of feedback. There's so many levels of culture where you can find readers now, from social media to big reviews in newspapers and so on. So you just never know who's going to find it and how.
You're sort of at the tail end of everything when it comes to your first book, really. You've sort of had the book come out, and then Paula, your book's out in paperback now, and Preeti, you've done some promotion work for it and that sort of thing. Is there anything, now you're sort of at the end of all this, that you'd wish you'd known at the start of it? Just because I'm thinking a lot of people that are listening are probably authors and would-be authors themselves that, you know, might want to get into being picked up by a big publisher. But was there any sort of surprise or a tip that you would give for someone that was getting into this game?
Just focus on the work.
Yeah.
It's all that matters. Make it as good as you feel it is can be in yourself. And don't give up, because if you've got that sense that it really is as good as it can be to you, then you know, it takes a lot of commitment to keep on sending it out. And, you know, in my case, someone else did that for me in the end, and that's how I found my publisher. But I feel like when I think about the ecosystem of small publishing and the big publishing, there's just so many options out there. So if you don't find a home with a big publisher through an agent in the traditional sense, there are more ways to get your work out there, and perhaps maybe think about those first, even, because some small publishers are publishing in ways in which you might think, oh wow, actually my writing's a lot more like that actually, and so perhaps I'll find a better home there and they'll support me more. You know, it's not just about being part of what you consider to be mainstream. It can be, you can find your own way.
And how about you, Paula?
I think focus on the work, and that has to be the main thing, because that's the one thing that you can be properly responsible for. And in a way, all the other things are a little bit beyond your control. But then also, I think it partly depends on personality. If you're the kind of writer who is comfortable on social media, you can probably be trying to build an audience on Twitter or wherever, and between selling your book and your book coming out, you could be making connections, following and being followed back by authors who you might then send your proof to in the hope of getting a quote. You know, all these things that take up a writer's time and are on a writer's mind if a book is coming out. And I remember that all being quite a surprise to me, actually, just the whole process of sending your proof out to writers whose work you really admired in the hope that somebody would find the time to read it and maybe have something to say about it.
I mean, how did you find that? Because you've got just in terms of talking about blurbing, you've got Hilary Mantel on your book, which
yeah,
is kind of cool.
Yeah, well, I wrote...
She wrote it.
I've always been a big believer in the power of a speculative letter, you see, for getting jobs or for anything. As someone who's not very good on the phone, it's always been quite helpful. So I wrote to Hilary Mantel and to a small handful of other authors whose work I love, had to be the ones whose work I really love, and hoped and was really amazed that Hilary Mantel found the time to read it and get back to me in that great way. Yeah,
I hope I haven't made it feel like too doom and gloom by talking about the money side of things, but I suppose it is like the reality of it.
Well, in some ways it is the reality, but you know that since I got published, I've been asked this question by some people. Ask me, what are you working on next? And that's nice because it's chat and I can understand why they're interested to know if, you know, you move on. And then people say, how many books have you... Some people say, how many books have you sold? And they divide into very particular kinds of people. The how many books have you sold question is from people who don't really read, usually.
Yeah.
And the reality of it is that the pleasure that you get from writing, the intensity of that relationship you have with your work, is so private. And then the pleasure of seeing it on the shelves, and even someone who writes you a snitty review, you think, okay, well, you read it and you've had your say, great. So the work is finding its own way in the world. That's the reality.
And I don't find the sort of author's earning statistics too depressing, in that although they are low, I think probably the percentage of authors who would expect to earn their main income from writing novels must also be pretty low, because really, is that a reasonable expectation? I think it probably isn't, and we have to be doing this while we're living our lives and as part of our lived lives, and being involved in that, you know, economic dynamic is important. I mean, that is, after all, how most people live.
I mean, I have to ask now, because the Desmond Elliot is for second book. Oh, it's first book, first support book. For second book.
Yeah.
How is the second book coming along? You're both doing very shifty eyes.
I'm sitting here.
Okay, I can. Well, I have been very lucky because I had a grant from the Authors Foundation at the Society of Authors, which has enabled me to take 2 months unpaid leave from work and still pay bills while I was doing it. So I have been working for 2 months on that, and this morning I've just laid out my 200 pages on the floor. I did it in thirds because I have a smallish room. So I've had the aerial view, and I know there's lots I need to do, but I have got pages of something.
Goodness. You just did a face pretty. I'm
terrified.
I can't imagine you doing that.
Because my publishing experience has been so different to, I think, what happens when you hand in a book to a big publisher, then it sounds like you have like a year between it coming out and then you do your editing and so on. So I was editing with Gally Beggars until like 10 days before the book came out.
God.
It was so intense. Yeah. And that happened for a bunch of different reasons, but some things to do with life and some things to do with the length of the book and the kind of and what we were trying to drill down to make happen. So I haven't really had a breather this year to start working, actually writing, but it seems to have happened anyway around going to different parts of the world to talk about the book, which I've been lucky enough to be able to do as it's come out in different countries, especially in India, where the book is actually set. So it came out here in the UK in August, and then it came out in India in November of last year, and the response there was just so completely overwhelming. It was fantastic. So there's a lot of stuff that I've had to do around that, which has been brilliant. But all the time my head has been ticking along into what's going to come next, what's going to come next. And I know what it's going to be. I know the landscape and the geography of that intimately. It's going to be set probably in the northeast of England, which is where I spent half my childhood, and it's going to be really tough. So I've kind of been putting it off because I know it's going to require a lot of me emotionally, but I'm going to get there. It's all there in my head. I just have to sit down and do the disciplined work of finally getting the writing on the page.
Well, like, I know that it sounds like it might be a work of emotional labour, but I'm very excited to read it and see what comes out. Thank you so much to both of you for coming in, and good luck. I mean, the winner of the Desmond Elliot is announced on Wednesday, and this episode goes out on Tuesday, so there'll be one day's wait if you're listening as it comes out. But congratulations to you both, and good luck.
Paula Kokotsa's How to Be Human is published by Hutchinson, an imprint of Penguin Random House. And Preeti Taneja's We That Are Young is published by Gally Beggar. On next week's show, we're lucky to be joined by Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and from Netflix show Cooked, who is here to talk about his new book, How to Change Your Mind, exploring the new science of psychedelics. Don't forget you can subscribe and review us, talk to us on Twitter at Guardian Books, or send us an email on bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But from me, Sian Kane, and our producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thank you for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.